good morning. Today's speaker is Stefan from Google. He got his PhD from Yale. He's a student of Ralph Kaufman. And he's working on hyperspectral analysis of documents and inharmonic analysis in general. Today's talk is clustering in general embedded spaces and organization.
All right, so first of all, I would like to thank the organizer for inviting me, giving me the chance to speak before you, and also my collaborators on this work, some of which have given talks or will give talks to the, this week. My point in this talk is to explain and describe a set of techniques that all these people and others, Peter and many other people, have been working on in the past few years. Set of techniques that we like to call diffusion geometries, diffusion models, or whatever. And the idea is that this set of tools is essentially a powerful way to organize data in a very generic manner. So I have to say that I'm no expert in text mining. I'm pretty sure that many of you really know like all the specifics of this type of data, and it's not my case. I mean, basically I can read, but that's about it. And, but beyond that point.
And you're a Kaufman student, that's pretty good.
Yeah, that counts. So, So we don't need motivation because we highly motivated people. So let's directly jump to the challenges. So some of the major challenges that we have to deal with when processing, you know, the type of data sets we're interested in, which I didn't describe by the way, are the fact that the data sets are high dimensional, they are nonlinear, they are very likely to be noisy, so you need some robustness in your methods. And they are very likely to be huge too. So if you could have methods to organize, extract some knowledge from data that basically sort of avoid or reduce the influence of each of these factors, that would be nice. So in this talk, as I said, I'm going to basically present what we call the diffusion framework. So there will be, I guess, some overlap with Rafi's talk, probably with Peter's talk. And you can view also my talk as serving as an introduction for Mauro's talk. So basically, my goal is to explain that with these eigenfunctions of specific diffusion operators, you can retrieve a lot of useful information from data sets. In particular, you can build coordinate systems. You can, when you have coordinate systems, you can do clustering. You can do a lot of things like registration and matching. Classically, this framework fits very well into the setting of the dimensionality reduction. Also, the nice thing is that it provides you with a useful notion of metric or distance over the data, and it's quite easy to construct. And in the second part of that talk, I'll basically focus more precisely on the problem of clustering, because now, if we have coordinates of the data, we can do more than clustering, as Peter said, but in particular, we can do clustering. So the question is, what does it mean to cluster in that embedding diffusion space? So let me review the diffusion framework. So I apologize for those who are already very familiar with it, but I will go through that. And if you feel that you need more details or less details, just let me know, adapt the pace. So the idea is that you start by building a data structure, which is essentially a graph on your data set, where each node is a data point, and you put an edge between each pair of nodes, and you're going to put a weight on each edge. So I will require that the weight for now, that the weight be non-negative. So the idea is that pretty much once you've built that graph, you're set. You've done most of the work. But that's essentially the hardest part of this work, which is the modeling phase. This graph is supposed to capture some notion of local affinity between the points, where affinity is a notion that has only a meaning in some context, the one of your application. And so there is no one recipe to achieve that goal. This is where you need an expert, I would say. because you will have to do feature selection, noise removal. You will have to know something about the data. But the idea is that you have to define this weight in such a way that it directly reflects some notion of local similarity between the data points. Typically, this number should be essentially one. Your points x and y are supposed to be very similar, and roughly zero otherwise. So these are basic examples that tend to occur sometimes. So you have cases where the data set already come with some metric on the data. And maybe the metric is not very relevant, like large distances maybe don't mean a lot to you. But at least you might believe that local distances are actually meaningful. At least the numbers returned by this distance as measuring bottom distances is meaningful, are meaningful. In which case you can build this kind of Gaussian weighted graph, which puts an edge between two points if basically, I mean numerically, if those points are within distance root epsilon. Also, we'd like to point out that in some cases, and we saw that in Andrew's talk yesterday, that sometimes the data already come naturally in the form of a graph. So every kind of network, the web, social networks, computer networks, and so on. So this is the modeling phase. Once you've built the graph, essentially the rest is easy, sort of. So this is the next step. You build the Markov chain on the data. This is something very classical. The way you do it is you take this matrix W that you built, which is an n by n matrix, where n is the number of points, and you renormalize it in such a way that you obtain a Markov matrix, that is non-negative entries, and the sum of all the rows is equal to 1. So P, and in particular P of xy, can be viewed as the transition, the probability of transition between x to y in one time step. And if you take powers, you get longer range, longer term transitions. So I minus P appears at various places, whether it is in spectrograph clustering, in numerical analysis. I minus P is often referred to as the normalized graph Laplacian.
Question, in the pictures you've been drawing, you're making W of X by look like an undirected edge.
That's right.
But there's no reason, right? It could be directed.
It could be directed, at least up to that point. When I start talking about spectral properties, then I would require some symmetry. Otherwise, the spectral theory is not defined.
Okay.
But that's right. That's a very important comment. So up to that point, you can consider that, okay, your graph is connected. This is still the web with like links, outlinks, and you follow paths that are directed. So the idea of this diffusion, one major idea of this diffusion framework is that this matrix P that you built, therefore the one-step transitions of this Markov chain, are essentially reflect the local structure of your graph, the immediate first-order neighbors in your graph, meaning that first you don't have transitions between points that are not connected, and the probability of transiting from one state to the other is directly proportional to the weight on the corresponding edge. So the idea is that already you have captured the essence, the infinitesimal geometry of your graph inside this matrix P. And the idea is that by running the chain forward, which is by taking powers of this matrix, you will see basically various structures appearing at different scales in the data. So this is a toy example where you have essentially three clusters in the plane. I form the Gaussian graph, build the Markov chain with matrix P. This is the matrix. And as I take powers, so you see already there was a specific ordering of the points so that you get to see some blocks. Otherwise, it's difficult for us humans. So this is what happens as you take powers. So basically, as you take small powers, you see three main diagonal blocks, meaning that the probability of escaping a cluster, where a cluster is a region of high connectivity, is very low. If you start in a cluster, you're very likely to remain in that cluster. So you see immediately you have three clusters at this scale. As you go forward in time, two clusters tend to merge because they were more connected than, say, the third one, and you see it immediately in that matrix. And as you go to infinity, you tend to this rank one matrix where each row is an invariant measure, the page rank, if you wish, of the graph. So this basic example essentially summarizes like the philosophical ideas behind this Markov chain modelization of the data. So it is now clear, if you wish, that not only time is a time parameter. It's also some kind of scale parameter that we will use at our will if you wish to tune the scale of the analysis, or possibly use several scales at the same time, like what Morrow is going to talk about later. So basically, the idea is like compute the probabilities of transitions at various times, see if it's a big or a large or a small number, and infer some structure on the data based on that. It is also a nice thing that basically the object of interest are powers of is the set of powers of P. So that's where I am going now to assume that the graph we started with was symmetric, because one idea, if you want to tackle powers of a matrix, is to look at its spectrum and its eigenvectors. We are not guaranteed in general that we have such objects. However, if you assume that the graph we built was symmetric, then there is such a guarantee. So for now, I will assume that the graph is symmetric. At the end of the talk, if I have time, I will go back to the non-symmetric case, because it occurs quite sometimes in practice. So we know that P has a sequence of n eigenvalues and eigenvectors. Those eigenvalues all are between minus 1 and 1 because the matrix was Markov, and you can show that the top eigenvector is this one with this eigenvalue because P is stochastic. And actually, this eigenvalue is only achieved once if P was, if the graph was strongly connected. So in that case, you have an ergodic Markov chain. So we have those eigenvectors, and we could basically use them, if we could compute them, that's another story. We could use them directly to compute the powers of P, but instead we're going to employ them for finding a parameterization of the data. So that means each eigenvector is a set of points, a set of real numbers indexed by the points in your data. So in other words, it's a function of the data points. So if you take three eigenvectors, you look at them for each point, you have three numbers, which can be viewed as representative of your point in R3. So the idea is to stack all these eigenvectors. So I'm skipping the top one because it's constant, it's not yielding anything, but you could keep it if you want. And we're going to weight them with some, appropriately with some powers of the eigenvalues. So we basically introduce this family of mappings. So each of them is taking your set, and it's mapping it in some Euclidean space of dimension n minus 1 or n, depending on whether you keep the first one. And so the effect of time, and we'll come back to that later, is basically to squeeze coordinates with small eigenvalues. So already you get a way to represent and see your data set as a cloud of points in the Euclidean space, which was not the original form, maybe, of your set, because maybe you started already with a graph. Already your graph lives in some Euclidean space. Euclidean spaces are nice because people know what to do in those spaces. They can do hyperplanes, balls, they can do some kind of covering. They know what to do and they feel comfortable with those spaces. We'll explain later what happens to those points in the diffusion space. But before, I'd like first to mention that these ideas have been in the air for at least 5 years, where at least in the context of machine learning, or mindful learning, should I say, with the various people developing methods that basically all aim at forming some kind of quadratic form and finding eigenvectors of this form and using them for parameterizing the data. So this is like, if you want, some kind of general approach to all these methods, some kind of unified framework. So let me show you an example first. So I downloaded this database of digits, and I focused on this cluster of digits that were like labeled as ones. So each point in your database is a 28 by 28 image, a pixel image. It's a grayscale image, and it's supposed to be a digitized version of a one that was handwritten at some point by someone. I found a basic Gaussian weighted graph with using the L2 distance, computed the Markov chain and its eigenvectors. And this is the plot of the data and the top two eigenvectors, where each point in this plot is an image in your database. Okay. So typically, this is how you get organized in the Psi1, Psi2 plane. In this direction, you're essentially capturing the angle. In this direction, you're capturing the width. All right. So basically it's nice because in some way it gives you the feeling that those coordinates were able to capture natural parameters of variation. And this in a nonlinear way, because you see that this angle thing is making a lot of things nonlinear. It's not translation, it's not dilation, it's not something like that. Well, you could have a rotation, but in some way the arrangement of the data could be thought of as some kind of manifold of a certain dimension. So you see, the nice thing, and that's the point of this illustration, is to think about it. What is the type of prior information that we injected in that experiment? We didn't know that we were dealing with digits. We didn't even know we were dealing with images. We took some L2 distance. I could have randomly permuted all pixels, but in the same way for all images, would have got me the same result. The idea was to use this blind L2 distance, take all of them between all pairs of points, and discard most of them. And that's what we do when we form this graph. We discard all distances that basically we think as irrelevant because they are measuring this. I mean, it's really the proximity between points that are actually far apart from each other. So if we have this assumption that the L2 distance is going to be meaningful only for close points, well, by building this graph, this is exactly what I'm doing. I'm filtering out what is important, what is not. And I've done most of the work, as I said before. Once the graph is built, the rest is automatic. So, okay, that's an example. Let me explain to you, or maybe refresh your memory about how points get organized in the diffusion space. So we had this data set in whatever form it was at the beginning. I'm not making an assumption on the type of data you're dealing with, but at the end of the day, you are in some Euclidean space and you have this cloud of points. So it can be shown, and it's actually easy, that the distance between two points in that space is just, so this is this thing, because you can measure the distance, the Euclidean distance in that space, is equal to this functional L2, weighted L2 distance. So these functions, you can view them as two bumps, essentially centered at x and y. Their scale is growing with t, and these are the posterior distributions of leading x and y and in t steps. So if x and y are highly connected in the graph, then transitions will be quite easy from x to y and y to x. So you would expect that these bumps would be mostly the same. Mostly. So this number should be quite small. On the contrary, if you take two points from two different clusters where there is only a weak connectivity between those points, then those, given, well, depending on the value of t, but for reasonably short values of t, small values of t, those bumps would be quite different, localized at different places on our graph. Hence, the L2 distance is basically going to be the sum of the norm, and or square root of the sum of the squares, or something of that kind. And basically, this number will be large. So this number, which is basically a function of t2, not only a function of the two points that you're using, but remember, we have a family of embeddings, so we will have a family of metrics, is what we like to term diffusion distance. It's some kind of instance, if you wish, of the resistance distance. The resistance distance is obtained the same way if you replace this matrix P by the sum of all powers of P. Okay, in which case you would get the pseudo-inverse of the graph Laplacian, or if you wish, the Green's function. And the diffusion distance would come down to the expected commute time between two points. So this is looking at a given scale. You can take a power series of your matrix P and look at different variations about this kind of metric. But let me just underline three good features about this distance. One thing is that you essentially detect the clusters in a very easy way. If you define clusters as region of high connectivity, which implies that the definition of cluster depends also on the scale, then, as I said, because of this dependency, if you wish, on the type of connectivity between two points, clusters will tend to contract under this embedding and will be set apart from each other. So essentially, you get those clusters. And actually, this is one way of understanding spectral graph clustering, which is take this Laplacian, compute at least the first non-trivial eigenvector, and use that to find the main bottleneck in your graph. That's one way of viewing that, extended to more eigenvectors. A more interesting comment, I believe, is the second one, which says that this distance between x and y is taking into account all paths of a given length between x and y. So it's a bit like what Andrew was saying yesterday. You could use various, other variations about this concept, but the idea is not to use the geodesic distance, the shortest path. This kind of distance is much more informative. It's really looking at all evidences linking from one point to the other at a given scale. So in terms of learning, this has a lot of potential. Running a nearest neighbor classification with this kind of distance might be very powerful. Actually, we have experiments that show that this kind of approach is superior to a lot of classical approaches, at least in a given setting. And for the very same reason, this metric is going to be robust to noise and to perturbations, small perturbations of your graph. Because, yeah, I think it's obvious. So let me finish this review of the diffusion framework by speaking about the dimensionality reduction aspect. So you see that in this tuple, depending on the value of t, not all numbers are numerically significant, because you're taking powers, so a lot of these numbers are going to decay to zero in a very fast way, and that means that numerically, if you want to embed the data in such a way that you preserve the diffusion distance to some accuracy, you can just retain a few eigen coordinates, namely those for which this power of the eigenvalue is larger than, say, a given threshold. So for large times, you won't need a lot of eigenvectors, because you're looking at coarse scales, so you're averaging a lot the motion of your random walk, and then you have less degrees of freedom in some way to describe the space of functions on the data, in which case you don't need a lot of coordinates. If you want to look at fine details, that is short times, then you will need a lot of coordinates, possibly. So the key to dimensionality reduction here is really this decay of the spectra of powers of p. I'm pretty sure that Mauro will show this picture again. Sort of central.
So you get a lower dimensional space as you get higher and higher powers.
Okay.
So in some sense, you don't have a single projection. You
That's
have
right.
A whole class
you have a family of projection. You can think of it as some kind of low pass filtering, and T is really like the bandwidth of your filtering. And in some way, you're filtering out high frequencies in the representation of your set. What is the finest detail that you are going to keep in your representation in some way. That's one way of seeing it. So you fix T, you get a scale, and you say, okay, beyond that scale, I'm going to throw away finest scales. It's really a low-pass filtering, if you wish. So we really have, as you said, a family of embeddings. All right, so now I'm going to describe a series of very basic experiments just to get you some kind of feeling or intuition regarding this kind of parametrization. So one thing is, okay, let's take an image. Let's chop it into a bunch of 7x7 patches overlapping. And now let's view that as a point in R49. And let's build the Gaussian weighted graph. And let's compute those eigenvectors. So this is the original image. Yes, there's something I didn't mention, which is sometimes you believe that your data set is subject to a set of constraints. So some people like to model this as my data lives roughly on a manifold or something of that kind. The question of whether manifolds exist is a different question. But you basically sometimes think of your data as being subject to some. Any comment, Peter? Yeah, I don't hear them. So, end of discussion in some way.
Carry on, though.
All right.
Time's
so,
not up.
So, we have sometimes a set of constraints that govern the data, and there's also an additional issue, which is the distribution of those points with respect to those constraints. And that can be the effect of various things: the way you sample the data, the type of acquisition device you used. Maybe you have dropped data by sending them on a noisy channel, things of that kind. So sometimes you really want to separate those two aspects. You really want to find, and that's what manifold learning is somewhat about, you really want to find a set of constraints and get rid of the effect of the distribution. So there's a way to, it's actually very simple, to normalize, if you wish, your graph in such a way that you don't see the distribution of the points anymore. And if the original points were already sitting in the Euclidean space. And basically, you get some kind of density invariant diffusion maps. And that is useful in practical situations. So you get those the two types of embedding by accounting for the density and ignoring the density. I mean, mixing up the effect of density and the constraints. So already, the nice thing here is that you see the effect of the grid of pixels. Here, you don't see it. Because of the grid of pixels, you're not going to sample, if you wish, in the parameter space, your image or the patches in a uniform way. Some patches will occur more often. And you're going to skew your distribution, your sampling, with respect to that rectangular grid, which you see here. Actually, if you could see a section of this, you would see essentially a square. Here, you have a round shape, which is nice. And the nice thing also is that if I remove some data points, suppose I drop those on a noisy channel, in not a uniform way, in some kind of skewed way, this blows up because obviously something is changing. Here you really get the same set of basically of shape. Of course, the points that are missing, but you get the same basically set of constraints. This is useful really in practical examples. All right. This is another example that we worked out with several people, among which Yanis, Mauro, Rafi, and Boaz. The idea is that we had this molecular dynamics simulator. We had this software that was simulating the evolution of a molecule containing 7 atoms evolving in some solvent. So you see that my definition of a document is very wide here. So these are typical configurations for that molecule. The molecule is evolving according to some potential, but at the same time you have like the solvent that is like having an action. Basically it's kicking each atom of the molecule, so the molecule is vibrating at all times. And what you get is really millions of snapshots of the molecule, and can you make sense of it?
Are those all the same atom?
Well, I call them atoms, but I don't believe they are real atoms. I mean, it's really, think of it as 7 particles, and they are subject to some potential. You could think of 7 atoms, but I'm not a chemist or a physicist, so I don't know if this kind of thing is really possible.
Just dots.
Yeah, exactly. Oops. Yes. So we get basically the positions of the atoms. We got also the velocities, but we discarded those for once. Something is going to happen soon. Yep. So this is the embedding that you get in 3 dimensions.
One of the great things about this example is it's not clear what the question is.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Well,
there you go. Look at that.
Well, yeah, in some way.
Now there are questions.
Exactly. You can read the questions from the plot. Well, I would say that physicists have already questions. They already have questions like, okay, what are the transition paths between the stable states? So this kind of.
You observe that question.
I agree. So this. Each point on the plot, in this plot, corresponds to a given configuration of the molecule. And I can travel, well, usually I can, on this object and see how the molecule evolves. So the color encodes the potential. Red is high potential, the molecule is not stable here, and this is the lowest potential configuration. And basically, you see already the path appearing. And the nice thing is that now you can work in this graph.
So we have no dots, it must be just so incredibly high potential you don't see any data points.
Right.
Okay.
That's right. So in that graph now you can compute what is to some resolution, some step size, if you wish, what is the most likely path that the molecule would follow from one point to the other. You can do this kind of computation. I think the overall goal is somehow to find a way to speed up Monte Carlo simulations by introducing constraints in your simulator that take this into account by some kind of potential viewing, knowing about this. So, okay, I think I should move on because time is running out. Okay, this is something we did with Yossi, which is, okay, sometimes you have data sets that are essentially the expression of the same system. It could be a mechanical system or any other type of source of information. And really, they were not sampled in the same way, but you see the same constraints in the data set. So you would like to basically match those two data sets. So one way to do it in a naive way, which is, I'm a naive person, so this is what I did. We took these two data sets with Yossi, I'll talk about these data sets later, and we lifted them in the diffusion space. And in the diffusion space, you know, you're in the Euclidean space, and probably you've reduced the dimensionality and captured what you think is the main, what they think is the main directions of variability in a nonlinear way, so maybe you can match them more easily in the diffusion space. So to make this less abstract, so Yossi and I, we went to Toys R Us, and we bought those masks. Actually, I had that one from a roommate who forgot it at my place, so it's not like I had it before. And so what we did is that we recorded three movies with the subject, guess who was wearing the mask, and we had to move our head and bend down along these degrees of freedom, and never using that one though. So complete random motion, if you wish. And you would expect that those three movies, if you see each frame as a point in a high-dimensional space, that those three sets would represent essentially the same, they would be the expression of the same mechanical system, where you had the articulation between your head and your neck, at least just keeping 2 degrees of freedom, those two angles, alpha and beta. So what we did is that we computed the diffusion maps on those objects, and this is what we got. Okay. Nice, we have like this kind of butterfly shape sets with pointy wings and so on. The next thing was, okay, can we align those? And by the way, we didn't align them in 3 dimensions. I think we went to dimension 15 or something like that. The way we align them by itself is interesting. I mean, you do work in diffusion space, you find some kind of linear matching between those two sets using a reduced number of landmarks, and then you can go back to lower dimensions, and you get a nonlinear way of aligning sets, and also you can relate the number of eigenvectors to the number of landmarks. So it's really some kind of sampling theory, if you wish, because higher order eigenvectors are going to capture finer structures, and this should basically be possible if you have enough data points. So you have some kind of Shannon sampling theory for sets. So we did that.
With the landmarks? Were the landmarks supervised or unsupervised?
Yes, they were. Yes, yes. Yes, so basically we had to say, okay, when Spider-Man is like this, then Pikachu, the yellow guy, is also like this, and that we did that for like a couple of frames, and we did that like actually for 8 frames in each plot, and this is so it's far from being perfect, but I think it's nice, plus it's fun.
Yeah, I should work with a choreographer.
Oh yeah, thank you. Yes, thank you. So anyway. Let's go back to real documents. So, science news articles. Oh, big surprise. So, all right, so we again studied this science news database of articles. We had like a bunch of, I think, 1,000 or more articles. And we built this feature matrix where each word is documented, each word is represented by a column. Instead of doing the bag of words representation, we did exactly what David explained yesterday, which is using some kind of mutual information between instances of objects, words, and documents. And, well, so much for the pre-processing part. As I said, I'm no expert. And yes, the idea is that, okay, maybe we can look at, say, first the rows and say, okay, we're going to do some clustering, or maybe not clustering, but at least see what the diffusion maps get you in that case. And I think those pictures were shown somehow yesterday by Mauro during Peter's talk. This is real document space. It's document in space. So we have. All right. So the labels, we had labels, as was explained yesterday, that were manually assigned to each document, mathematics, history, or so on, or something else. And this is what those colors are representing. Those labels were never used for completing the embedding, but that's a way, if you wish, to verify that you get a good separation. Of course, 3D is not enough, so you should move in higher dimensions or look at other pairs of eigenvectors in general. And then, on the left side, so let me change a few things. On the left side, you have essentially Google search. Another type of Google, say a web search engine. And these are the documents, although like they were given to us. And now you can pick a point, any point. So, all right. This thing is about, okay, astronomy, I believe. And then you can say, okay, I'm gonna rank all other documents with respect to their proximity to that document of reference. So it's a new version of PageRank, if you wish, with more eigenvectors than the top one. And what you do, so, well, you're supposed to say, oh, it's about the same subject, so it works. And yeah, it's about the same subject, so it works. So basically, this is the kind of ideas that we've been dealing with. Use more eigenvectors, because classically, people have been looking at only one eigenvector, so in the context of solving some approximate version of the normalized cut problem, or if you look at PageRank as a way to rank web pages, you look essentially at the invariant measure of that Markov chain on the web, as Andrew explained yesterday. So this is not enough information. You can go further. So for the rest of the talk, I'm going to focus more on the topic of clustering in the diffusion space. So now we have data sets. We can embed them in some way in a diffusion space. So in the diffusion space, you have coordinates, so you can do a lot of stuff with coordinates. You can, parameterization is a powerful concept, so you could do this alignment of data sets, as I showed earlier. But you can do things that are a bit more coarser, I would say, by clustering the data, grouping. So this is the main idea, grouping in the original space, grouping in the diffusion space. So this is somehow more meaningful. You expect that the diffusion coordinates are going to capture the nonlinear structures of your data and provide a more appropriate representation in which clustering will make more sense than in the original space. So, all right, so let's go back to the setting of a graph. I'm still assuming that the graph is symmetric for now. Suppose I'm given k subsets that are forming a partitioning of that graph, of the nodes of the graph. And I want to coarsen the graph that I call G, that had n nodes, the original graph, into a smaller graph with k metanodes, where each metanode is really the union of all nodes within one of those subsets. So a classical way to aggregate, if you want the information within the subset, is just by summing all edges within that subset. So now we get a smaller graph. If the original graph was symmetric, that's this. The same occurs for that one. If the original graph was strongly connected, this one is also strongly connected. Yes. And then you can form a Markov chain again. So now you have a Markov chain on a smaller state of space of states, only k of them instead of n. So I'm not talking yet about how to choose those things. I'm just describing one possible process for coarsening a graph into a smaller graph. So once you've done that, so this is the main idea, okay? You get this.
Sorry, you've just contracted each subset?
Yes, it's just, if you want, a thought experiment. You just see that, you just say, okay, I view this as one entity. That's it. And yet, so of course you have to create these kind of self-referencing links if they didn't exist before. And so the question is, how faithful is that graph to that one? So this is a big question. You have to specify some kind of objective in what is the kind of information you want to retain. So if I decide that the type of useful information in a graph is its top eigenvectors and eigenvalues, then maybe I can say something about what happened to those objects when I coarse-grain the graph.
So typically when you coarse-grain, you know, you lose a Markovian property because you'll have a tail term. So what are you losing when you do
that? I just took this graph, I made this graph.
Right.
Okay. Now on this
graph. But I mean, if you have a Markov chain over a course in state space, you know, so.
Yes, you do have one, because now you have again
right.
A graph. I can build a graph in the same Markov chain.
But you're opposing a Markov property, so you're throwing away the non-Markovian effects? Because you're looking at a course in state.
I'm not
space.
Sure what non-Markovian effects you're referring to.
So what it does is it defines a new Markov chain on the contracted
right.
graph, and now it's going to compare
those two Markov chains.
This new one.
Okay,
so
the only
one
may have no relationship, or it may be
right, but
one.
It's built on a coarse-grained version of the graph, so you expect some relationship. And the way I'm going to measure, if you want, this relationship is by comparing, say, eigenvectors and eigenvalues of those.
And so you'll be able to say something about the conditions under which they're close.
Right, exactly.
So
and this is going to impose something on the choice of these the partitioning. And this is going to define, if you want, if you wish, a notion of best partitioning. Actually, it's just justifying what people have done for years. It's nothing new in some way. So
let's back up to the previous picture for a second. So with weights, I know what you might do. So the weight in the self loop and the edges between these S1, S2 are just sums. But if you had a Markov chain, would you sort of use a steady state distribution to compute some sort of, because after all, the transition probabilities now are, you know, it's from a bunch of states instead of one state. So if you wanted them to sum to one and so on, you'd have to do something more. So what would you do if this, if you wanted to do this?
Oh, you mean directly working on the Markov chain,
yeah,
as opposed to the graph?
I mean, if you wrote down weights over there, if these are just some non-negative weights, I know what you're doing. That
yes.
Coarsening operation is well defined.
Yes.
Okay, yeah, let me see.
This is what I'm doing.
Okay.
So you take this big graph, you get a small graph. And on that small graph, I can repeat the operation of forming a Markov chain the way I did on the...
Okay, so you're renormalizing the new
exactly,
weights.
Exactly, yes,
and
yes. I see your question.
Okay.
Yes, you renormalize with respect to those new weights. So somehow, I guess it's related to your question, right?
Yeah, no, I think, I'm thinking you define one that's sort of an induced chain, which needn't be Markov, and there'll be a tail piece, which is non-Markovian, which is sometimes small, sometimes not. But I think that, in this case, basically comes into how close is the best approximation, and that's
small, right.
The best approximation.
That's right.
Not otherwise.
So is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay, thank you. All right, so suppose I know that psi L is an eigenvector of P, the big Markov chain matrix, so it's an n-long vector, with eigenvalue lambda L. Then I can build those vectors that are k-long vectors by aggregating, or averaging, I should say, the value of psi L over each subset with respect to a weight, which is the invariant measure of the big Markov chain, or if you wish, the degree in that case, because for symmetric graphs, it's the same thing. So that's something you can compute. So this is a vector of length k, which can be applied to p tilde. It's not an eigenvector of p tilde, but my claim is that it's close to one. And the extent to which it's close to an eigenvector of p tilde depends on the choice of those objects. So basically, this is the result. This psi L is approximately an eigenvector of p tilde with eigenvalue lambda L, up to a deviation of order d, where d is that sort of scary expression, but it's not actually. It's simply take your set, embed it in the diffusion space, assign a weight pi to each point, and this is the distortion quantization, the quantization distortion induced by the partitioning SI. Okay, so it's the expected, it's the mean distance between any two points within a cluster. There's a square here that is missing. All right, so it looks scary, but it's not.
So are the eigenvalues distinct, you're assuming, or not?
The eigenvalues are still somehow the same up to some precision. So basically...
No, so sorry, in the original problem, are the eigen, is the field of the spectrum, are all the eigenvalues distinct?
No,
okay.
It doesn't matter. Because all you want is, if you remove the tildes here, you want this to be zero. So the fact that it's degenerate.
So the eigenvalues...
The fact that it's... The fact that they are distinct, I don't think plays.
I mean, it makes sense that the eigenvalue
because
would be robust, but the eigenvectors might rotate.
You see, if you have multiplicity in the eigenspace, in the diffusion space, it's just like having a rotation. It doesn't change the quantization, doesn't change your k-means algorithm, doesn't change anything. Right?
So you're if they rotate, you're also choosing a preferred rotation in order to.
No. I'm just saying that everything is invariant up to a rotation in a degenerate eigenspace. So I don't believe that this has any influence. I mean, if an eigenvalue is repeated.
And that, I mean, I'm sure it's not related to this particularly, but in the long run, what you really want to do, which is select the model selection, what is the dimensionality you're going to work in,
mm-hmm.
It has an enormous influence. If you,
definitely.
Okay.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah.
And also, I would like to add that basically you can work with powers of p. I leave that to Mauro. But here I'm putting t is 1, but typically what you want to do is take powers of p and... When you do powers of p, remember some coordinates are going to collapse in the diffusion space or are not going to be included. So it's like taking your set, projecting to lower dimensional spaces, and doing the quantization in that space. So basically, this is just a justification of what people have been doing for years, which is, like, for instance, Mela and Shi, what they did in the context of segmentation of images was take your image, take a lot of pixels, form a graph, and you want to segment this graph. So what you do is you take top k eigenvectors, whatever k is in their mind, embed the data in the diffusion space or eigenvector space or eigenmap space and run k-means. So this is a justification in some way. It's going to say, okay, if I run k-means, somehow I'm aiming at minimizing D. So I'm aiming at finding the best SI in terms of preserving the spectral properties, that is the top eigenvectors, of the larger graph when being coarse-grained. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's essentially the idea. And okay. Yeah, so we did that for, we went back to the Science News database, and we looked at the columns of this matrix Q. We are looking at words this time. So this is the plot of the words, some of the words, because we had to filter out a lot of things, do some pre-processing. And this is the plot of the words in the top two eigenvectors. So you already get, only in two eigenvectors, a nice organization, like astronomy, medicine, weather, and a lot of things. Of course, you have a lot of collapsing here, but you would have to think of it in higher dimension, in higher dimensions. So now in this space, or in with more eigenvectors, what you want to do is do some k-means, or instead of doing k-means, you can like release the constraint on the number of clusters and instead work on the distortion itself and do some covering. You can cover with balls of a given radius. And this way, to ensure that the distortion will be no larger than given threshold. But then you can have a growing number of clusters. So this is typical, these are typical clusters that you would get. What we call diffusion centers is the point that is, one point that is the closest to the centroid of the cluster. This one should be somehow a good representative of this cluster. So it's somehow related to what you said, Mike, yesterday, like the importance of not getting eigengenes or eigenpeople. So that's a way to get it. So of course, it's not uniquely defined, because if this is your cluster.
So these aren't data points, these would be the medians of the
exactly.
cluster.
Exactly, right, right. So no, you look really at the center of mass of it,
right,
with respect to pi, and it's really like taking a conditional expectation. And you take the closest point, or one closest point.
So the data
so
point closest to the center.
Right, right,
mass.
Right. But it's not necessarily uniquely defined.
Yeah.
So.
Which should be fine. I mean,
which
is
okay.
Done this.
Right. Means that either is good if you have two of them. Yes, you can go multi-scale by looking at powers. And I'd like to finish the next 2 minutes by looking at what we can do, or maybe we could do, by about symmetric networks, non-symmetric networks. So I'm going to take a broader point of view. I'm going to look at graphs that can have like negative weights, I mean signed weights, non-symmetric weights, and I'm going to add also a notion of node weight, which is basically a number attached to each node, a positive number, and basically I want this number to reflect the relative importance of a node within the graph with respect to other nodes. So if that helps, you can think of your data points as being sources acting on targets, where the data points are also targets, and the interaction is not symmetric. You can see also your view the picture of a flow. The directed graph is like a bunch of pipes. There are various ways of modeling this kind of setting. The idea is that you can retrieve the diffusion framework by first imposing that W be symmetric, be non-negative, and by constraining pi to be the sum of the weights of W. Right. Here I'm saying we don't have to do that, because people actually have been using like Gaussian graphs that are not normalized and just use them as embeddings. And so there must be something we can do. So this type of graph is actually important in reality, in real life. So Andrew mentioned yesterday that in the case of PageRank, the problem is that you get sinks, that is absorbing states. And so what the Google people did is that they said, okay, I'm going to perturb my Markov matrix by a rank one matrix. So even though the matrix is dense, it's still rank one, so it's a perturbation argument. So basically, I can still compute those eigenvectors in a very efficient way, at least the top eigenvector. So, and doing so, I'm still directed, but I'm avoiding, say, being trapped in absorbing states. There are a lot of considerations when we're looking at directed graphs. We want to avoid that graph. This is not always a good graph. It's difficult to reach equilibrium, so I don't like it. What?
You could wait a long time.
Oh yeah, yeah, you can wait a long time. If you're a very patient man, that's fine.
But that's not a...
You see, in the diffusion framework...
No, but I mean, things will never converge if you have this bipartite.
Exactly.
But that's not the interesting. I mean, does that appear in sort of a malicious way in this context, or it's just an FYI you're just mentioning?
It's more FYI, yes. You have to be aware that things, you have to know something about your graph if you want to, especially if you want to take powers. Another type of graph that you don't like is that one. This one has no absorbing state, this one has one absorbing state. You don't know. What you want to do is maybe that, or something of that kind. Anyway, I don't decide what graphs look like, so I'm going to talk about the fact that basically you can still apply this coarsening scheme, right? You can still, okay, I'm going to take an arbitrary partition, I can do this coarsening of the edges, this one, this time those things can be signed quantities, and I have to define a way to coarsen the node weight, but the simplest way, I think, is to aggregate over a subset. And when you do that, so we don't have spectral embeddings anymore, but we still have embeddings when you think of it. If you found this matrix A, which is basically what P was before, but this time it's no Markov anymore. It's not Markov anymore. You can view each row as the kind of signature of the point. Right? So you can do the same thing as before. Why not take each point, embed them in Rn by looking at the rows of A, or some powers of A, but again, with powers, you have to know something about your graph, and do some quantization there. So the idea is that, okay, I can still coarsen the graph into a small graph. I can form this matrix for the smaller graph too. And to compare G and G tilde, I'm going to compare A and A tilde, okay?
So the main difference here is that the n in Rn is n the number of points, and no diffusion embedding was done. So the dimension is still high, and...
I completely agree. Yes, before you had the reduction of dimensionality, provided you could compute those eigenvectors. The dimensionality is still high, but I don't think it's really a problem if, say, you look at small powers of A, right? You could work directly with the columns, the sparse matrix, suggesting I have a bunch of sparse vectors in high dimensional space. I don't think that it's particularly difficult to run k-means in that setting. Okay. Typically, if you want to compare those matrices A and A tilde, one is N by N, A tilde is K by K, it's really looking at whether, so you need to relate them. So we use a refinement matrix, sometimes called also partitioning matrix, which is this matrix N by K, where each row is an indicator of the subsets in my partitioning. And the question is, the idea is that those two matrices should approximately commute, and the extent to which they don't commute, if you wish, is some kind of distortion, and this is precisely the result. So the reason why I'm acting on the left is that I want to preserve the rows of the matrix. So this is my measure in terms of norms. So basically this is the result, which is, okay, those two matrices, which are both n by k, approximately commute, and the extent to which they don't is essentially this distortion. And that's taking the points, embedding them with the rows of A, and measuring the distortion you get by due to this partitioning. So if you like spaghetti, it's about food. So this is awful. It's, this is the Antarctica food web. So food web is a network describing the feeding relationships between entities. So this is a broad definition.
The ones who like to have lunch together. You.
What?
The ones who like to have lunch together. You.
Exactly.
I have exactly. Lunch for lunch.
Yeah. And I like this one. So so in this graph, x points to y means y eats x. I know it's a bit strange, but it's really like a flow of energy rather than someone eating someone else. So this is the convention representing food webs. So it is believed that this food web, so this is a subset of all entities you might find in this region of Earth, but it's like 36, I believe, entities. But it is believed that this is one of the simplest on Earth. The other end of the spectrum, you might have things like the rainforest or something like that. But still, you want to make sense of this set of strings. And so you apply this k-mean stuff with k is 5.
What kind of sense do you want to make?
All right.
What's the question?
The question is, what is the question?
What
on some ways. No, really, it's what am I going to find by clustering this graph in a way that I want to preserve, say, some kind of rank structure in the adjacency matrix, if you wish. And so I didn't even describe what matrices I'm talking about, but I took W to be a 0-1 matrix, which is actually a bit crazy because you would want to have the weight to be the to reflect, say, the flow of energy, the amount of energy that is going to transit from one entity to the other. I took also the node weight to be uniform, but in some way you would like to be to have the weight reflect, say, the relative population sizes or something of that kind. But already with some simple stuff, this is just an illustration. This has no pretension of explaining what's going on this, in the South Pole. This is the kind of clustering you would get. So what is interesting is not so much that penguins are with penguins for most of them, and that whales are with whales. So the idea is that if you cluster the rows of A by look where A is formed as P inverse W, you're really grouping species with respect to their predators. So meaning two species are likely to be together in the same cluster if they share the same predators. Okay, and actually, what is interesting, I believe, is that cluster, this cluster, because it is known, actually, if you look at the literature in this field, that those three species are actually in the diet of almost everyone there. So these are really central entities. And this food network, this food web is really vulnerable to any alteration on the population of these things, especially krill. Krill is some kind of shrimp-like microscopic animal. And you could also work on the reverse.
So sorry, what does a bidirected arrow mean? Bidirected edge.
Oh, it means that you have an edge from one. So it means, I just wanted to. It means that you have an edge from that one to that one, and that one to that one.
So it means that krill eats a blue whale?
No. No. You have things like that. You see, this is a huge cluster because K was only five, I believe. Yes, it's also very funny that.
CO2 and sun.
Yes, right. So.
Why is this a good clustering?
Ah, good question. I don't know. I'm not even sure it's a good clustering. I'm just saying that the nice thing is that obvious things that people know, as I said, this has no pretension of explaining everything. But obvious things that people know, like the importance of those three species in the network, already pop up immediately to you. Actually, this is not dependent on K. I mean, for a reasonable range of values of K. I did some experiments, and basically those ones always pop up. You can work also on the reverse graph by reversing the directions of a graph, which is like taking W transpose. And here you're grouping species with respect to the prey they feed on. And again, whales are together and so on. And you will see that these ones are the lucky guys, because basically they are never eaten by anyone, except that, yes, the killer whale will eat the leopard seal. But that's about it. So these ones are like, you wish to be reincarnated in those people if you could. Because no one is going to kill you, no one is going to mess with you. And so anyway, I think I should stop now and just take a few questions. Yes, this is the conclusion. So basically, yes, this diffusion framework is some kind of, I believe, powerful set of tools. And because it introduces these diffusion distances, the clustering in this diffusion space is also meaningful, but you can go beyond clustering, as I think I showed by this alignment example of graphs. And I think everything can be extended to directed graphs, provided you know what kind of graph you're dealing with. And I think Mauro is going to underline the multiscale aspect of this work, which is, okay, now we know we have a family of embeddings and metrics. The question is, can you work with all of them, what scale is more important? How do you find this? In terms of functional approximation, you want to regress a function. What do we know about the vocabulary, the pieces that this framework provides us with in terms of describing the function as a sum of rows of the powers of the matrix of bumps? So I leave it tomorrow to speak about multiscale stuff. So thank you for your attention.